Hope, it's been a little while, hasn't it? I almost fell foul of the podcast Don't Make It Past 3 or 4 episodes stat that I mentioned before the last episode, but after being hospitalised with an illness, it's good to be back podcasting. The guest on this episode is Martin Ross. He's a fascinating follow on Twitter, if you don't already, at Martin Grant Ross, and he's the global news editor at Sports Business. He's also a big Scottish football fan and has his finger on the pulse when it comes to broadcasting and sponsorship. So that's what we're covering off today. Enjoy. Martin, welcome to the podcast. Can you just take a second to introduce yourself and talk a bit about your current role in the industry?
Hi, Chris. Yeah, thanks for the invitation. And happy to give a bit of background. So I'm the global news editor at Sport Business, which is a role I took up in August 2019. So I oversee all the daily news output, while at the same time do quite a lot of the writing and interviewing myself. We've had a big radical overhaul of the Sport Business news service in the last 2 years. So, yeah, generally, I mean, in non-COVID times, that would involve going to events, going to conferences, networking, and writing about sports industry. That can range from media rights deals, sponsorship, event hosting, people moving around the industry, financial results, broadcast productions, and sort of pretty much any facet of the industry you could think of. So, I hope me being a journalist is not going to turn away all your listeners. Although, having said that, it's kind of a very different kind of journalism in the sense that we're writing within an industry. So
that's what I was going to ask you as well, in terms of that difference. And obviously, it's super focused on kind of sports business. And my next question was going to be: did you start your career as a journalist, or have you always been into this space?
No, I didn't. And I mean, the difference actually is quite interesting in that I suppose regular newspaper journalism, which I've never been a part of, but I imagine the difference is, you know, we can't burn our bridges with our sources very easily, or our audience, should I say, as opposed to our sources, because our audience is the industry. So we have to play it a bit carefully and, you know, take people to account when we have to, but cognizant of the fact that we are part of the industry and we're relying on them for information, so it's a slightly different tactic. But anyway, yeah, I did do some journalism at university, wrote for the uni newspaper at Glasgow, but I studied languages and then went, and my first job was in 2004 at SportCal. So that was doing a little bit of writing, couple of kind of pricey stories every day, but the role was actually as a sports researcher. So I was finding out information about where sports events took place, who was organising them. Even actually, my first day there, I was inputting Belgian football fixtures into the calendar, which, to be honest, I kind of thought I might be doing this at home. So this is actually pretty enjoyable, which probably says more about me than does about the job. But it was, it was a real kind of sports geek job, and then went on to join the news team 2 years later.
And then have your roles since kind of progressed from that? Have they all been relatively similar, obviously working your way up to where you are now?
Yeah, I suppose there was kind of natural progression. At the time, there was a team of four new journalists at SportCal, which grew to 5. So I moved out to Switzerland in 2007. We opened an office there. Just as you can imagine, all the international federations, continental federations, IOC agencies that are based out there, and moved back to Scotland in 2012 ahead of a bunch of events that were being hosted. My role changed around 2013, 2014 to take on sort of leadership of the news team there at SportCal. Kind of natural sort of progression. And then I left in 2019. There was a takeover, and long story, but a few of us decided to go off and do different things. So I then made the kind of Mo Johnson, Kenny Miller style move from one rival to the other.
I was going to just kind of kick off the topics with something that hopefully you're familiar with, and I know you write about quite a lot, and that is broadcasting and a lot of the deals that are around in a lot of the countries and for the leagues. Obviously, when it comes to broadcasting in Scottish football, the SPFL and the Sky TV deal is one of the hot topics when this comes up. Can you take us through some of the ins and outs of the deal as you see it? Obviously, last season there was a bit of an issue around kind of number of matches that were expected to be showed on TV Live versus what was actually shown on TV Live. What happened there?
Yeah, it was, I suppose, the opposite of what I thought would happen. And when I say that, I mean, the league and Sky agreed a compensation deal during the COVID time, just after it struck, and to, as you know, to allow the clubs to stream their matches. And that deal was worth, in terms of a rebate, £1.5 million over 5 years, which, if you took sort of the usual Sky methodology that they had for rebates for the English Premier League or for Rugby League and stuff like that, even on a kind of apples and apples basis, this was way below what we thought they'd be getting. So the natural inclination, and I think it was reported at the time erroneously by one of the newspapers, was that Sky was going to be getting more matches last season. So yeah, they kicked off in you know, July, August. I think they showed 13 games in August. And the expectation was that they were going to certainly meet the criteria, even go beyond it. In terms of what happened at the end of the season, I mean, I think there was just, they had various calls to make at the end of the season and options to take on the matches, and they just said no to them. A lot of it, I think, was to do with the way the season ended, because there were no, not so many sort of final day relegation issues, or because Rangers won the league so early. I think they looked at the scheduling versus other football they were putting out and thought, you know what, yeah, I mean, they ended up showing what was it, the second leg of the Kilmarnock Dundee playoff, but not the first, I think.
Yeah, I think that deal kind of started a little bit strangely, didn't it? I think it was announced and then the one of the matches had already started, something like that, I think.
Yeah, so that was very late. But even in the relegation kind of run-in, if you like, very, very few matches, if any at all, actually. I'm trying to remember if they showed any of the relegation kind of matches towards the end. Yeah, it was, I think, just an issue of scheduling for them at the end of the day. I haven't actually counted up the number of matches they ended up showing last season, but I'm sure it didn't hit 48, which was the contract.
Yeah, no, I think that's part of the reason for my question, I think, to be honest, because you often see it. Obviously, a lot of people do track these things and kind of hold Sky to account a little bit on Twitter and things like that. And it definitely came across that it wasn't as many as it probably should have been. And I guess that leads on to my next question as well. And maybe this is one that you can bring in a little bit of your own opinion on, or you can compare it up against other leagues that we're almost competing with, if you like. But would you say we're over or under valuing the product of Scottish football on TV?
I would say that, I mean, I suppose I would ask who we are, I suppose, as fans or the people selling the rights. I mean, I think in terms of the people, the league selling the rights, I think there was perhaps an undervaluation in negotiations with Sky and BT previously. I think they did a pretty good deal last time around to bring in what they did from Sky, which I think is just around 26 million, just over 26 million a year. The higher figure that you always hear bandied about, always, that includes Premier and BBC and all the rest of it. So that brings it in line with equivalent countries by, in terms of the size of the league or pay TV subs, Switzerland, for example, which has a bigger population, but is a kind of equivalent. So that brings it in line with that. So I think that last deal has brought us in line. I don't think we could be accused of overvaluing the product. I mean, I suppose we've got to remember, and I'll probably, you know, make myself unpopular by saying it, but I mean, there's really only four matches a season that people down south, I'm talking about, would tune in to watch league matches. I mean, so you've got to trade that off against how popular it is domestically, which is very popular. You know, there'll be a lot of Sky subscriptions in Scotland, which are reliant on the SPFL rights. And across all clubs, you know, fans of all clubs, of course, there's two that skew that and will lead the subscription numbers. But I suppose we've got to, on a global scale, remember where we are, you know, and the clubs that we are, and leagues that we are up against, you know, and compare ourselves to Belgium or Switzerland, as opposed to, you know, other leagues, and not look down south, because I think that's risky.
Yeah, I think that's a tricky thing, isn't it? Always to, yes, we probably border one of the most ridiculously priced, in my opinion anyway, ridiculously priced TV deals in history. So yeah, it's really tricky not to look down south. And you mentioned the obviously the four Celtic and Rangers matches that happen on a season by season basis at the moment, and how that's viewed maybe down south and obviously internationally as well. I think, again, maybe looking back a couple of years, but again, something that is often raised when this topic comes up is the international product when it comes to selling the kind of TV deal internationally. Has that improved in maybe recent years, over the past year or so with last season? Is there much of an international product for Scottish football?
Yeah, I suppose we would need to sort of dissect what we mean by product, and then also have a look at, you know, what the fee is that they're getting. So, I mean, by product, has it improved? Depends what you compare it with. So, I mean, if you go back to the sort of mid-2000s, at a time when there was a whole bunch of star players, and you look at Nakamura playing at Celtic, he alone brought in a Japanese TV deal worth £1.5 million a year. That just doesn't happen nowadays. So the product, when you talk about product, I mean, that often means the players playing in the league, you know, international players. Of course, you know, the Steven Gerrard aspect has generated more of a product, in inverted terms, for the league. When you also talk about products, you know, you can actually, we can be technical about it and say that the TV production has improved for the international takers. There are other things you can do to that to improve it a bit more that other leagues do, you know, that build in a whole bunch of graphics and kind of AI generated data to try and differentiate themselves from other leagues. So, I mean, yes, the league could do that, but it would involve a spend. It's probably all want to do. I was talking to, I think, the Belgian league last week. They're sort of building in augmented reality figures into, you know, the kind of lineup that you get. These are the kind of things that you could add to the product and the rest. But I suppose the most important thing is, how much is it worth, and has it grown in value over the last years for the international broadcast rights? I mean, no, it hasn't. It's stayed pretty level for the last 10 years or so, and they now bring in about £1.3 million a year for the international broadcast rights. On top of that, though, which is really important for leagues like Scotland, is what's called the betting rights. So that's selling the video to bookmakers so that they can stream the matches to all their customers on a much smaller screen online. These are actually pretty valuable and would bring in another, I don't know, I'm guessing about £500,000-£600,000. So yeah, clearly you take that figure and match it up with the big five leagues in Europe and it's absolutely nothing. But you compare it with, you know, Switzerland, Belgium, your actual rivals, and it's probably on a par. Yeah, so it's They're doing what they can. What they need, I suppose, is a few more star players would be good from different markets. That would really help to sort of kick things off a bit.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I think maybe it's me, maybe it's what I've seen in terms of the chat around this, but I feel like we often think about the clubs when we're thinking about the products, but thinking about it in the player perspective, and like you said, that Nakamura example is pretty staggering, to be honest. And yeah, I think that's it's tricky to think in that way. And I suppose the clubs don't maybe they do, and Celtic and Rangers probably do attempt to think in this way. Obviously, Aberdeen have just brought in an American, well, US international, I was going to say, I think he had two caps. But maybe the clubs can be encouraged to start thinking in that way again.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's ever... Are there examples of Scottish clubs doing it? I mean, I suppose when Celtic followed it up with, who was it they bought? Was it Mizuno?
Koki Mizuno.
Off the back of Nakamura. That may not have been a sort of... I think the commercial team may have got involved in that one, perhaps. but if you look at the German clubs, for instance, they, for many years, have looked internationally and have bought a bunch of Japanese and Korean players across lots of different clubs have done so, which, you know, has been as part of the league's international push. I don't think that's ever really happened in Scotland, and I would kind of warn against it in the sense that, you know, the players should be bought on their ability first and foremost.
Oh, completely, yeah.
But even I think when Dundee United had a Japanese goalkeeper a few years ago, I think, and it did spark off some interest all of a sudden in a TV deal there, which hadn't been there.
It's amazing the power of players, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all local interest. It's just to make your league more interesting. But as I say, that on top of the sort of the four big games that people would want to sort of tune into anyway, but to generate that kind of week by week interest is what would make the difference.
Completely. One last thing on this specifically just now is I was going to ask, the SPFL seem to be preferring longer term deals at the moment. Why do you think that is?
I think it's where the industry is at the moment, Chris. They are not unlike other rights holders. They all want financial security right now. So you have people trying to take advantage of that actually at the moment. I mean, private equity is another discussion, but they're doing that. And broadcasters and sponsors are going to leagues and saying, look, we'll give you X, which might not be as much as you want per year, but we'll give it you over 5 or 6 years. And they like that security. If you look at Infront doing a deal for 5 years for the international rights, you look at Cinch, which I'm sure we'll talk about doing a deal over long term. You look at Premier Sports tying up the League Cup right, including the sponsorship rights as well. The other element in Scotland, especially, I would say politics. I think it sits quite nicely for the SPFL and the CEO to be able to say, I've done the 5-year Infront deal, I've done the Sky deal, I've done the title sponsor deal. Everybody's working a ticket naturally in this industry, and for him to be able to say he's done all these puts him in a nice little position. That any CEO, I'm sure, would probably work in that way. So I think that shouldn't be forgotten as well.
Yeah, he's got to earn his money at some point, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. But he's also got to, you know, make himself attractive if he's looking elsewhere.
For yeah, completely. You know,
he's been here a while now. I certainly have no knowledge of him going elsewhere, but I'm sure he has looked elsewhere during his time at SPFL, as you'd expect him to. So he wants to get all these ducks in a row and has done.
The pandemic kind of accelerated and forced some of the lower league clubs especially to go down the in-house broadcast route, and that'll obviously continue into the new season as well. What opportunities do you think that brings for clubs, and what problems do you think have arisen from it as well?
I mean, I would say that first and foremost, opportunities is that relationship with the fan. I mean, obviously traditionally that relationship was just the fan coming through the turnstile every 2 weeks and buying a pie and a programme, whereas now improving that direct-to-consumer, direct-to-fan relationship helps you. I mean, it helps you upsell. It in itself is a benefit to have a more of a relationship and have more data around who your fans are, especially the guys who, you know, gone in and bought pay-per-view who aren't season ticket holders. Can you then translate them into season ticket holders? Can you sell them more pay-per-views for friendlies, for European games? Can you sell them other products? So that has 100% been a benefit for the clubs, I'm sure. Also, just becoming content creators is a good thing. There is quite an industry shift, and I would disagree with a lot of the European Super League kind of ethos and numbers that were thrown around, but their argument was that the clubs, you know, hold the rights and the clubs should do the deals directly and have the relationships. But creating content, you know, building your own club channels if they, for the clubs that didn't have them, creating studios, I think it was all a beneficial thing to do. I mean, I suppose from a cold-hearted financial sense, if you look at some of the smaller clubs, and I think it was Ross County who played Celtic on pay-per-view terms, and I believe the game wasn't on Sky, so the Celtic fans had to buy the Ross County pay-per-view, which brought them in, I don't have the exact figure, but it brought them in well into, you know, six figures. And, you know, I'm sure Ross County are absolutely delighted with it. So that's been a huge benefit. And if you look at some of the prices they were charging, club by club, it was not a small amount. Clearly it's helped the bottom line. And in terms of problems, I mean, there's the technical problems, clearly, which the Twitter army always gets extremely excited about. But I think in general terms, it went pretty well. There's the additional costs of, hiring for host broadcast. There's the additional cost of building up, taking on board editorial people, presenters. There's editorial decisions clubs have made, some of which have done well, some of which I think if Hibs reflected on one of their choices this season in terms of bringing Evan Welsh into a studio, possibly wasn't the best idea. But they never knew, it's easy to say that afterwards. So it's just got them to think in different ways, I think. It's got them to think. Previously, they were just kind of stakeholders within a league that had a kind of media product that they weren't really that responsible for. Of course, then building their own digital platforms and social media over the years has changed that. But this has gone a step further and got them to sort of control the look of the live product in many ways. I think they're in a much better place a year down the line for having done so. And I imagine this season's offering will be, even better than last season for having the experience of doing it.
I was just about to say, fascinated to see what this season brings. And I'm sure it'll be different, very different, if obviously fans are back in stadiums as well and trying to weigh those two things up against each other and also marry them together as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It was naturally a bit rough around the edges, I think, some of the coverage, as you'd expect. I was watching a St. Johnstone game, and at one point they just listed all the names of the match sponsors for about 45 seconds, which is fine, but it's maybe not the sort of thing you expect if you're paying, I think whatever the St. Johnstone figure was, it wasn't small. And there was also, of course, the Hamilton example with the co-commentators. But it could probably be a bit smoother next season. But then again, it's Scottish football, and these are the things we quite like about it. It is a bit insane.
Definitely. Talking of insane a little bit, really, they're always kind of muted for potential rights deals. And I'm not just talking about Scottish football as well. And obviously some of these names in terms of Facebook, Google, Amazon have got involved with some sports rights over the years. But do you think it could ever actually happen that becomes the norm, and they are the ones that are broadcasting not just Scottish football, but football as a whole?
Yeah, I suppose we'd have to take them each individually. And I mean, Amazon is the closest to doing that, and would be the closest, I think, next time the SPFL comes to market, they would be the most likely to be getting involved of those three. I mean, if you look at Amazon internationally, you have the Premier League package in England that they have for two rounds of fixtures, but they've now got a package of Champions League rights in Germany and in Italy. They've got Roland Garros in France, and they've very recently got League One in France rights to eight games a week. And that was really unusual in the sense that up until now, kind of rights holders and the SPFL would have to do this and sort of come up with what they would call an Amazon package. And by that, they mean something that appeals around Amazon's kind of retail strategy. So with the Premier League, it was a package that was designed for Amazon to sell Amazon Prime subscriptions ahead of Christmas. Because it was the matches before Christmas. Similarly, with the Champions League, they kind of dip in and out with one match every match week. Whereas in France now, they've actually gone all in. And the reason they did it was actually because it was for various very long reasons. They were the rights were available cheaper than they would have been. So Amazon's the most likely. In terms of Facebook, I think the strategy has changed. I wouldn't expect Facebook to be coming in and buying exclusive rights to Scottish football. They went through a period of doing some exclusivity. I mean, they did Champions League deals in South America, La Liga in India, Copa Libertadores as well. The strategy's been kind of tweaked a bit. Now seems more focused on non-exclusive rights, partnerships with existing broadcasters. Mm-hmm. So there's no signs of Facebook. And they were always experimenting. There was never signs of them going sort of completely all in. And they're further away from doing so than they were previously. And even further away would be Google, YouTube. I mean, their primary objective is really to use their reach. So to be to amass a whole bunch of channels from rights holders. SPFL have a channel up there, all the clubs will have a channel, and to build advertising revenue on the back of that, to be pretty mean about the advertising revenue that they hand out in the other direction, but also be a solution for smaller properties that don't have a TV deal, and so they end up going and streaming something on YouTube because they can't get a TV deal. But I mean, YouTube have never sort of gone out and bought exclusive rights. They have experimented a bit with a kind of pay-per-view model on there, but they seem no closer to doing so. I mean, I think you'd need to widen it out to look at OTT generally, and I mean, what DAZN has done over the years, and other players in that space. So it's a complex one, but I don't see the death of pay TV, linear pay TV subscribers coming anytime soon. Amazon have the pockets to really challenge if they want to. But if you look at the deals they've done, it's been pretty sort of calculated. So I imagine that will just continue, and it will coexist with your Skys and your Sky equivalents in every other country.
Just one of the things recently that's come up in terms of Google and YouTube is that UEFA and DAZN deal to broadcast the Women's Champions League for free. How big is that, do you think?
I think what's really important to look at this deal is the model of it. So for DAZN to go in and get a property and
DAZN, sorry, I wasn't sure how to pronounce it. I just say DAZN.
The industry didn't know how to pronounce it for a long time. I mean, it is meant to be DAZN. That's why it's DAZN. For them to go in, get these rights, and to say that for the first 2 years, all of the games will be available free mm-hmm. on YouTube. Thereafter, they will be on a subscription basis, but there will be a certain number of games free. To keep UEFA and its sponsors happy. So this is really, I mean, it's really and unique, actually. I can't think of an example where a subscription platform has committed to 2 years of free access to a product. So what they're trying to do is build that product up and then monetize it. And also at the same time, marry that against keeping UEFA happy, because they wouldn't have done a deal with DAZN and allowed it to be behind the paywall exclusively. Could be really interesting. Could be a real good test of the model. It is ballsy, because, you know, you're not getting any direct, of course you're getting an advertising return, I suppose, in the first couple of years, but it's all about building awareness for the first couple of years and then trying to sort of maximize that afterwards. So I'm really interested to see how it goes. It's also unusual, I suppose, for to get, you know, a property such as this globally. I mean, of course, it's not anywhere near the values of the men's Champions League rights, but the audience is sort of market by market for the women's Champions League final stages have been going up in major markets for the last few years. So they've done well to get these rights worldwide, with the exclusion of, Middle East and North Africa is not included, and nor is China. But it will perhaps be either be a trailblazer or it will be a disaster, one of the two. But I don't think it will be anywhere in between.
Fascinating to watch, then. One to keep an eye on, definitely.
Yeah.
Just finally, on in a kind of broadcasting section, if you like, I've seen this quite a lot recently, and it was obviously it came up a little bit with the Super League stuff that was raised a few months back now. But we've been told a lot that fans don't have the patience for whole matches anymore. What's your views on that?
I would look at, I suppose, the match, where the match is, which competition we're talking about. I mean, certainly I would direct you to the very recent Euro 2020 audiences. So Germany, England, they had an average of 27.4 million viewers on ARD, which is Germany's sort of BBC equivalent. That's 76.5% share of the audience. But importantly, within that 14 to 40, 49-year-old, which is kind of your target audience and your demographic that everybody talks about, It was 10.4 million, and that was an 84.7% share. These kind of figures are mirrored across all major markets at the moment. The audiences are there for major events. We're here in Scotland, we're talking about, you know, new generations of Scotland fans getting to watch and getting interested in the Scottish national team. They're watching the games. They're watching the games in full. They're not just going to Twitter and watching the goals. Every conference we go to, we're told that there's diminishing appetite. I think the diminishing appetite argument, I think, is true when you look at week by week pay TV broadcasters churning out league after league, live match after live match. I think that's where the fatigue is coming in, and that's which was starting to impact a little bit on, you look at the top kind of leagues, perhaps starting to impact a little bit on rights fees as they start to flatten. Now with COVID coming in, clearly they're faced with the challenge of whether these fees drop. But football, certainly, and big football matches, and if you look at the English Premier League last season, the big matches towards the end of the title race, they were generating record figures. I just don't think there's maybe that same excitement that there was 10, 15, 20 years ago when pay TV broadcasters started to amass, you know, live football to a whole bunch of different leagues, and people were excited to sign up so they could go and see Serie A, La Liga, Bundesliga, or whatever, all in the same place, and watch as many games as they could. Whether that's me maybe not having the interest I used to, or it's hard to tell, but I just sense that for the games that don't really matter, people would rather just stick on Twitter and watch the goals legally or illegally and consume it that way. But the big appointment viewing, I don't think that has changed at all. And I think people are very much watching whole matches for the big appointment.
Let's move on to sponsorship then. And I think if we're talking Scottish football, the hot topic is the new Cinch deal that you alluded to earlier. The rise of online car retail has been huge recently, and the SPFL have jumped on that as well, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. I mean, it's kind of like the new betting sector at the moment, online car retail. So with Cinch and Cazoo being the main two, I mean, across those two, they've Everton, Aston Villa, Darts and Snooker. The reason for Darts and Snooker, I think, is Matchroom, which is Barry Hearn's company, have got on board with it pretty quickly and signed deals with them. England and Wales Cricket Board, Lawn Tennis Association, Queens, So rugby as well in Northampton. So it's been across the board, and it's been a real kind of concerted effort over a 12-month period. And yeah, SPFL are the latest to sort of ride on the coattails of it. Interesting, yeah. I mean, they didn't do this deal directly. So it was TV6 Sport Collective, which is a London-based consultancy. They're the ones that did the deal. That kind of prompts me to ask myself, why has the league paid a commission to a consultancy to do a deal in a sector where everybody kind of knew that they were the obvious ones to speak to? I would say in response to that, that I suppose it's all about relationships, and they probably had the relationships with Lynch, maybe SPFL didn't. But, you know, I mean, the reason you've asked me the question is you've noticed that they've been on the rise. So if you're out there looking for a title sponsor for your competition, you would think they'd be one of the first sports to call. But as I say, it's probably a relationship that they had that they were able to leverage, and that's why they did the deal and they get their commission.
Do you, from a monetary perspective, and again, it comes back to the question I asked you earlier about the Sky deal as well. It's another long-term deal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a long-term deal, which makes me think on an annualised value, it won't be what the Ladbrokes deal was worth. I mean, the Ladbrokes deal, when it was signed, so what was that, 2015, it came into effect, I think it was £2 million a year, which then became 2.1. It then took a bit of a hit and went down the way. Now, the SPFL, who are very clever with their communications, I believe they came out and described this as a record deal. They can come out and say it's a record deal, I suppose, on the basis of it being 5 years, and they can build, you know, they can add the numbers each year together to create the record value. It's also that would discount the SPL deal, you know, the Bank of Scotland deal back in the day, because that's not an SPFL deal, if we're being technical about it. So by those metrics, I suppose you could describe it as a record deal. But yeah, the fact is it's been done over such a long time would tell you that they're looking for the security over a long time. But, you know, good brand. I mean, that lots of other people are getting involved with. So everybody loves to batter the SPFL for being controversial. I don't think this is controversial in any way. We've swapped betting for online car retail, so that is no bad thing in terms of the wider social argument. But I'm sure, yeah, label it as a sort of we buy any title sponsorship.com deal, which would be unfair, because I think it looks like a decent deal.
I'm intrigued to see what is going to come next from it, and what plans are going to be kind of used to activate the sponsorship. I feel like obviously the rumor on Twitter, or the joke on Twitter, was Ryland's going to come up and present the league title to whoever wins it at the end of this season. But
I suppose, I mean, he's not going to get banned. I mean, certainly none of the clubs have had a problem with that. I suppose that's no bad thing. There used to be, who was the Bank of Scotland? Was it Howard?
Was it not Howard? Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great. If we could get another personality on board, then absolutely. And build off the back of Ryland's, which I imagine huge social media following, then absolutely. But so one thing they won't be doing is activating around his manager of the month, which was really unusual. Glenn's Vodka, the deal that was done recently, Glenn's Vodka did a deal which included manager of the month. I don't think it included player of the month, but that was a bit of a bizarre one, because it meant that they were then trying to find a title sponsor, but they had to say to them, look, when manager of the month comes around, you're not going to have your name against it, which is pretty unusual. But they've got around it and done the deal nonetheless.
Yeah, intriguing to see what's going to happen next with that one. From a personal perspective for me, my only thing is it's an industry that has kind of come from nowhere, and we're kind of locked in for the next 5 years. That's my only worry at the moment, in terms of is this space going to continue to be so huge over the next 5 years? I'm not sure. Obviously, it's kind of always been around a little bit in some guise or another over the past kind of kind of few years, but yes, Cinch and obviously the Carwow as well, and there's quite a few in this space now, and they're all competing with each other.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a lot of upfront investment, a huge amount of marketing investment. If it goes belly up in the next couple of years, I mean, I presume there'll be security around the contract and so on. But yeah, I mean, it's a good point. If that sector kind of implodes, where does it leave SPFL and others who have signed long-term deals with them? Yeah, it's hopefully it's not too good to be true, and then all plays out well.
Yeah, that's maybe the pessimist in me there a little bit. One of the things in terms of sponsorship recently that has really been catching people's eye is obviously TikTok. They signed up for Euro 2020 just recently with Burnley Women as well, which I think includes a little bit of broadcasting as well, which is super interesting. And obviously Wrexham recently too. What have you made of TikTok and their kind of moves into European sport?
Yes, and the Wrexham one's interesting in that it's, you know, there's a lot of kind of traditional kind of sponsorship aspects as to that, whereas a lot of the deals they'd done, and the Burnley deal as well, been quite reliant upon streaming. They'd done a couple, Brazilian football, Serie C, they started streaming that. Pakistan Super League cricket as well. And this all came off the, I mean, initially when they came into the market, I mean, they're owned by a Chinese company called ByteDance. And they, just about 2 years ago was when they made the move, and they appointed somebody to head up the sports move, if you like. And that first came by getting rights holders to set up accounts on TikTok. And since then has kind of moved into live streaming. I'm too old and too unfashionable to be on TikTok. But I mean, my limited perception of it as a user was that you got 30-second videos. So to have a live streaming capability has been quite a departure, because up until then it was kind of shorter content. But yeah, and now actually moving into more sponsorship elements, of course, with the, you know, the Euros and the UEFA deal, which has been, which will be a huge one. So big spend, but they've got big numbers behind them, and you know, big audience there. So hopefully it can make it work. I'm sure they've got a lot of clever, creative people at TikTok and each of the rights holders to put out some really clever activation stuff. And yeah, good luck to them. It's good to, it's good to see them getting involved in clubs with, you know, I don't know, you can associate Burnley, Wrexham as maybe having boring kind of betting sponsors or kind of local, I don't know, local car dealership or something. So for something like this, I think it's great.
Yeah, obviously, I think from Wrexham's perspective, TikTok's basically all over Hollywood now with Wrexham's owners sending around kits and training gear and things like that, which has been fascinating me over the past few weeks.
Yeah, certainly that's shaken up a few things, that ownership. Wrexham and Hollywood, not two words you would usually have in the same sentence, but what a delight that they are through this deal. It keeps everybody's lives interesting.
Definitely. Talking of that, then, what's the best bit of kind of sponsorship activation that you've seen recently?
Probably one which, you know, a very low tier sponsorship with a big company, but the activation around it was brilliant. I don't know if you saw the Stevenage Challenge. Burger King came on board as a Stevenage sponsor and then encouraged players on, I'm pretty sure it was FIFA. Encourage people to sign up the best players, you know, Mbappe, Messi, all the rest of them, on there and build up their team and play against good teams. And then when they scored goals, share it on Twitter, and then they'd get rewards with Burger King. So it was incentivizing them there. The traffic on that was unbelievable. And the reach that they got for a sponsorship of a lower league conference football team was just astonishing, and it was so clever, and it got a lot of good, you know, kudos in the industry as well. And also it married, you know, the kind of digital element of everything. It was right in the kind of sweet spot of the audience you would want to be in, you know, boys and girls playing FIFA. It was just, yeah, it was so well done. And the videos that they brought out are off the back of it. It was creative. Yeah, really impressed. Really, very impressive. Hats off to, I mean, before that, Burger King had been years ago. I loved the slightly more simplistic activation of when they used to sponsor one of the Spanish lower teams in La Liga. And when they scored, they kind of built, they printed the Burger King guy, the king or whatever he's called, under the shirt so that whenever the players scored, they would put the shirt over their head like Ravinelli style and have his face on their face. Which, yeah, it was a bit more simple. But creative nonetheless. So, yeah, that would be my choice.
I like that, definitely. Was that Getafe in Spain?
Good question. Somebody like that. It may have been.
I feel like I remember the kit and it was blue and it had the Burger King on it. Well, somebody will be checking it as they're listening. Now they'll be Googling it. I'm sure it was Getafe. What do you think is next in the sponsorship space then? What's the next big thing, do you think?
Funnily, I mean, there's a video doing the rounds actually earlier this week on virtual overlay technology, i.e., you know, when you have your LED boards at a game and use technology to go in and overlay different brands in different regions so that if you're at the game, you don't notice a difference. But if you're watching in Asia, you see a different sponsor. If you're watching in North America, you see a different sponsor. They've now got to the stage where they kind of, they have this non-disruptive technology and at the level. And there is a video that I send it to you, the one that's doing the rounds on Twitter, which is just so impressive of players playing pretty close to the boards and not noticing any difference. Whereas about 4 or 5 years ago when this tech first came along, or even longer, it was fine from a kind of camera point of view, but from the main stand camera, but then the minute you would get a tighter shot, it looked pretty clumsy. So, I mean, it's not, to my knowledge, been used in Scottish football, but I think that technology and what it offers in terms of selling different sponsorships in different markets, in terms of adhering to betting legislation, alcohol laws in France and stuff, I think it's really cool. And I think it's now at a stage where it will be rolled out everywhere. And it's very next gen that you could be sitting there watching a football game, having no idea if the sponsor you're looking at is actually sponsoring at the ground or not.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting. I guess it might need a rollout of the proper LED boards across all of Scottish football. I'm sure some clubs might not have even got to that technology yet.
Yeah, that would be nice. Well, I see Rangers now have their mid-tier, which is pretty cool. So
I was going to ask you about Rangers as well a little bit. Obviously, from a sponsorship perspective, they've been very impressive over the last 18 months or so, season and a half. Impressive on the pitch last season and impressive off it as well.
Yeah, they have. They've been, a lot of the marketing stuff they put out once they won the league, I suppose there was, depending on who you support, you would say it was overkill or not. I don't know. Without revealing my true colours, which people could very easily guess anyway. I think they. The marketing around winning the league was very smart, really good branding. I've been impressed. Yeah, I've been impressed with the number of deals they've been doing. The mid-tier LEDs, as I say, they put in. I mean, it's all, there's a guy, James Bisgrove, who was at Team Marketing, which is the agency that sells the Champions League rights. So he'll have brought some of his thinking from that along, I'm sure. There's an element of how many deals you do, how many do you announce? I get the impression they're announcing absolutely everything at the moment. I mean, there was even a supplier deal. I did a deal with Molton Brown, I think, some of these contra deals that, you know, we shouldn't confuse some of these deals with, oh my goodness, Rangers are bringing in lots of money, for some of the lower ones, I mean. But there's, of course, the risk of overkill if you start to, they now have they have a brand at the sort of on the back at the top, a back at the bottom, on the sleeve. They've kind of reached their. They now have a short sponsor as well, of course, with BitKey. You're at almost at the stage of clutter, but not quite. But I think he's done very well and has They've been very good at putting stuff out to the fans. I'm sure James is, you know, building up a good portfolio of stuff for his next move, as he should do, as anybody would do, you know, in that position, and appears to be doing a good job.
I love that you bring that in. You mentioned it for Neil Doncaster as well, and for James Fisgrove.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm cynical, but I mean, if you want to say, I'd happily take on a bet that he'll be working in the English Premier League in 3 years' time. But that would just be an opinion.
We'll see. We've got this podcast as proof that you just said that, so we'll come back to it definitely. What's one thing that you'd bring from elsewhere? Then obviously you cover a whole raft of leagues and sports on the website. What's one thing you'd bring in from elsewhere into Scottish football to improve it?
I think just generally the match day experience probably could improve. I mean, the digital experience has clearly improved through circumstance with COVID. I still feel the match day experience, not necessarily maybe, depends which league you go to, I suppose. I mean, if you compare it to the US sport, which is a bit unfair because they have decades of focusing on that and are brilliant at it. But, you know, I've taken people from different countries to Scottish football before and just kind of almost played on the fact that, you know, we're going to go and watch football and have a pie and maybe a Bovril and that's about it. You know, there may be a sort of activation at halftime that, but, you know, you're not going to wander around the ground and see anything interesting or maybe, you know, or buy anything of note. Yeah, I feel that that's still a bit lacking. It's the reliant upon the fact that fans are really just desperate to go there and see the football and go home. Plus, they also, I'm sure clubs know that they can't, you know, be too gimmicky about stuff that will not go down well with supporters. But if you compare it maybe to, and it's different and it's a very, sensitive argument between rugby and football, but certainly I would describe going to Murrayfield for the rugby, more of a kind of day out experience, and, you know, getting some music before and people drinking before and good, decent food outside, all the rest of it. I can't think of maybe a cup final I've been to up here would been a bit more of an experience around it, but there's not a match day experience around football, I don't think, which is a bit of a shame because I think it could bring in more, you know, kids who get a bit more involved in it.
No, that's a good point. Do you think in terms of comparing football to the kind of rugby Murrayfield experience as well, do you think it's more around the kind of sheer number of matches that happen across both sports? Obviously, rugby's a little bit more of a, it's not as every week.
Yeah, true. I mean, I suppose the Warriors matches and the rugby matches won't have the same level of stuff to do around the game that the Scotland matches will. But just bringing in maybe some elements of it would be nice, as opposed to, you know, you go to games and you see dads or mums taking their kids along and having to bring an iPad to keep the kids entertained if they're at that age when they, you know, need that excitement that maybe the action on the pitch is not bringing. So, yeah, I would like to see clubs being a bit more creative about it and taking some of the lessons from the States and elsewhere.
No, definitely. Talking about the States and maybe just sport elsewhere in general at the moment, it seems like everything I read is around crypto or blockchain or NFTs. How far away do you think we are from these things infiltrating the Scottish sport landscape?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, I think they already have to an extent. Rangers have launched their fan tokens with BitKey, began trading last week, I think. So there's been an example of a cryptocurrency deal there. NFTs or non-fungible tokens, however you say it. Andy Murray's now all over it, so in a way, involved in Scottish sport. It's going in one direction at the moment, so yeah, I can see them doing more. For some reason, I've got Morton and a very early crypto deal in my head. I don't know if that's true or not, but again, I'm going to check that. But for some reason, I associate Morton with cryptocurrency.
I'll need to check that one with the team. I'm not sure if one rings a bell with me, but we'll
no, I may be wrong. Anyway, Yeah, they are trailblazers over in Greenock. So, yeah, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will filter down. Scottish football still seems quite sort of traditionalist to me. I don't know. I feel like trying to explain crypto or blockchain or NFTs to a lot of the fans right now, you'd be met with a pretty short shrift. But I, like anything, you know, as you've seen with the Cinch deal, which, you know, we are an extension of the sports marketplace, I'm sure this will be seen a bit more.
True, definitely. Martin, coming to the end, just a final three. Have you got any advice for anyone listening that wants to work in the sports industry?
Yeah, I mean, network as much as you can, but in post-COVID, we're unfortunately getting out of that stage of Zoom calls only. But yeah, get out there, meet people. I would say don't be too parochial. You know, there's a big world out there. You know, it's not just about a couple of sports and the UK market. Go and learn, go and look at case studies. We have a huge advantage in that, you know, English is the language of most of the sports industry. So, I mean, Europe, North America, most of Asia, Oceania, a lot of them cannot speak English, but a lot of them communicate in English through the stuff that they put out as well. So, yeah, I mean, go out and learn about, I don't know, Israeli tech firms which are involved in sport massively. There's a virtual overlay technology companies in Germany and so on. Get the bigger picture so that you can stand out when you, even if you're looking just to get a job in Scotland or the UK, whatever, but you know, you will stand out for that experience if you're lucky enough to go out and get some experience abroad. Then do so. Yeah, I mean, just broaden your horizons, and yeah, just get to know people. You've got to sort of play the game a little bit, and help to sort of make a mark.
Perfect, perfect. I'm doing a bit of outsourcing with this next question and putting the onus on you to see who I should be speaking to next on the podcast.
I think it's been long enough in that we're probably ready for Barry Hearn to return. and to be honest, Barry's and the guys at Matchroom are usually on the front foot. He's usually pretty keen to talk. He's got a new role now, which means probably fewer hours in the office. Yeah, the guy's fascinating and is not afraid to say what he thinks. I think Scottish football kind of needed to hear that at the time. Has it changed anything? Perhaps not. Yeah, I would get yourself on the phone to the Matchroom or World Snooker Tour or PDC Darts and see if Barry wants to give his lessons for Scottish football number two. It could be a platform for it.
God, I would love that. I actually went on that BBC article from when he was up at the annual convention. I don't know, it was maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago now, and just had another read of it. Because yeah, it's pretty fascinating read still. And like you said, I don't think too much has changed since he was up.
Very interesting that he was speaking at an SFA event. And chose to say what he did. I would love to know kind of the briefing that he what was discussed beforehand. I'm not party to this, but I mean, I'd be amazed if there wasn't a bit of a discussion about what are you going to say, Barry, and any internal politics, SFA versus SPFL. I just find that, yeah, very interesting as to the stage you took to deliver that. But yeah, I think it's probably time for him to
and we'll see what I can do there. I'm not promising anything to any listeners, but we'll see what happens.
I mean, you could just lie about your traffic and your reach, you'll be fine.
we were talking off air before we came on, and I think I might know the answer to this next question because things are starting to ease up a little bit in places. But first sporting event that you'll be looking to get to next?
Yeah, well, I'm very lucky to be going to Wimbledon later this week, so looking forward to that and looking forward to talking about networking, actually just seeing some people again and picking up some, you know, tidbits about what's happening in the industry, stories, but yeah, really looking forward to that. I'm sitting here in a Yes, sir, I can boogie hoodie, actually. So that would reveal to you that I was also very lucky to get to Wembley for the match recently. That was just a huge thrill to be able to go to a match again and to see Scotland at a major tournament ultimately. And sadly, it's resulted in the only point we got at the tournament, but that was brilliant. And then beyond that, I mean, I'm looking forward to going to football next season in full crowds, sit with my dad, and I'm looking forward to hugging strangers again. That will be fun. Also, the Open. I'm going to the Open. It's down in Sandwich, which, really looking forward to that. It's outside, so a bit less COVID outside, which is good. And looking forward to getting a bacon roll, a cup of tea, and watching some golf. That's the plan.
Sounds ideal. I was just wondering if you were going to wear your hoodie down to Wimbledon.
I suspect I might get kicked out. I don't want to be described as in the prawn sandwich brigade, but I may get kicked out of hospitality wearing a hoodie. So I might have to save that for the football, sadly.
Fair days. That's it. Thank you so much for coming on, Martin, spending an hour with that. That was fascinating. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for the invite, and good to chat. And if it makes good sense to anybody, or anybody picks up anything, then great. But even if not, it's been good fun. And thank you for the invite.
No problem. Thanks very much. And I will speak to you some point soon. That felt good to be back, and I hope you enjoyed it. Just a reminder that you can find Martin on Twitter at MartinGrantRoss. And if you did enjoy it, please do consider sharing the episode with others. See you next time.